Before we get to our show, here is a podcast we think you're going to love.
Welcome to Sins and Survivors, a Las Vegas true crime podcast. I'm your host, Sean.
And I'm your co-host, John.
Join us each week as we delve into the underbelly of this vibrant city, exploring its most unsettling true crime stories, where the stakes are high and the truth is often darker than fiction.
But this podcast goes beyond the crime scene tape. We unravel the intricacies of domestic violence, exposing the raw and haunting realities that echo through the city's streets. Sins and Survivors is available now wherever you get your podcasts, because in this city of illusions, the truth is the darkest bed of all.
Hello, hello. It's Perhaps It's You. My name is Liz.
My name is Samantha.
And we are checking in from the crumbling empire known as the United States of America to talk to you about a TV show that was on a long time ago. It's extremely important. It was called Unsolved Mysteries, and it was hosted by a guy named Robert Stack.
Or Bob, as his... I guess co-workers like to call him.
I hate that every time. I can't explain it.
I always find it jarring.
I don't like it. It's Robert Stack. Show some respect, please. You're not his friend. You know what I mean? He doesn't care about those people.
They may have been, but I feel like
no. Yeah, you need to put I know they weren't. Did they ever go to his house? Did he ever, like, make them banana bread? You know what I mean? They're not really friends.
Do they ever have a day trip on his yacht?
Yeah, I doubt it. I really... Unless he was trying to sleep with them. So, wow, I just made a lot of wild speculations. That's what we do here at Perhaps It's You. You're welcome. I don't really have any updates. I mean, maybe I should, but I feel like I'm pretty forgetful. So nothing really comes to mind.
Nah.
Yeah. No, me neither. I guess we could just like get right into it, but that feels unnatural.
Yeah, I feel like we need to have some chit chat at the beginning. Do we need to talk about the weather, maybe?
Yeah.
I know people must love that. Maybe you could eat something and chomp into the microphone.
Yeah, some mouth noises. Should I just go on a really long rant about the mayor like I did that one time about plowing? I like could not stop complaining about that. That was fun. You kept being like, wow, Liz, thank God Liz got that out of her system. We can move on. It was like, and another thing. I just like couldn't let it go. The Minneapolis Police Department, which are a bunch of murderous clowns, recently spent nearly $1 million on a marketing campaign, which included Yeah, that's exactly what we need. Also, the video included some footage of a city that is not Minneapolis.
Well, none of them live in Minneapolis, so they wouldn't know.
They apparently can't tell the difference between Minneapolis and Baltimore. So that's cool. That's cool. I'm just saying business as usual going over on here. Almost $1 million, Samantha. And they couldn't even get it right.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That's going to help their PR situation.
I have not watched it yet, but there's apparently a recruitment video for Peoria, Illinois, which is like where my whole family is from. And it's like Call of Duty, but for real.
Peoria, Illinois?
Yeah. I was like, oh, wow. That's a really great. That's exactly the type of people you want patrolling your streets. The people that are looking to play Call of Duty for real.
Great.
So anyway, the hellscape continues. We're hanging on somehow. Thank you to everyone who has sent us really sweet messages about how this podcast somehow makes life more bearable. I don't really understand that, but good for you. No, I'm kidding. I love our listeners. They're all sweetie pies. That's why we keep making this. And also, I don't remember what we talk about, so I also get the delight of listening to this podcast, and I do enjoy it.
Like, oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Samantha edits it and then sends it over to me so I can make sure I didn't say something truly out of pocket. And then I listen to it and I go, these girls are delightful. Delightful. So we are on season 8, episode 14, I believe.
Yes.
We have been doing this for over 6 years. That's wild.
Hard to believe. There's not much of anything I've done this consistently.
No.
For this long.
I went to a zine club meetup the other day, which if you don't know, zines are like little booklets you make yourself. And, you know, you had to like go around and say a little bit about you. Also, everybody that makes zines, by the way, they're like so young. They're so young and they're so cool and they're so queer. And then there's me. And when it got to me, I was like, oh, I don't know. I guess I've been making zines for 8 years now. And everybody was like, oh, man, whoa, 8 years. Oh, boy. I was like, yeah, because 8 years ago you were being born. So that's why that seems like a long time.
Them and Arden.
I know. Hi, Arden. We love you. Okay. Oh, wait. There was two more things I wanted to complain about. Oh, thank God I remembered. Okay. So one is that I recently had a meeting with someone, and I cannot emphasize this enough, but this was not about podcasting. This was about like art shit, which is what I supposedly do. And at the top of the meeting, the person was like, oh, you have a podcast? And I, you know, whatever. You gotta talk a little bit about your podcast, try to get people to listen to it, right? So I was like, oh, yeah, I've been doing that, but, you know, more than 6 years now. Meet friend Samantha, blah, blah, blah. And she goes, well, if it hasn't made it by now, it's not going to.
First of all,
I literally did not ask. Second of all, I know, bitch. You think I don't know that? You think that I think the mattresses are on in the mail?
They just got lost.
I know. I'm never going to get the, like, I don't even know what any of the things are anymore. I'm never going to get some, like, Spotify $1 million deal, right? This podcast is not buying me a beach house in Malibu. I fucking know. Oh, thank you. Thank you for that. So there's an important update, everyone. This podcast is never going to make it.
Okay, here's my issue, among other issues, is like, what is their definition of making it? Like, success can be measured in multiple ways. I sort of think we're pretty successful. Maybe that's naive, but like, we have people who have been listening to us for 6 years talk about unsolved mysteries. We can sustain ourselves financially, sort of.
The thing pays for itself, right? It's not a drain on us.
Yeah, have I been able to quit my job and do this full time? No. But I guess if that's your measure of success, we're a horrible failure. But I don't know that that's the only way to measure how successful this is.
Yeah.
Or even if we were just doing it purely as a hobby, that's not like a bad thing either.
Yeah.
Not everything has to make you money. I don't know. That's just a very weird way of thinking.
I think it's like it's a very American way of thinking. And also I realized, no shade to people who live there, but the person I was talking to is in Los Angeles, and I think their bills are like way steeper than my bills, right? So I think they have to be like very focused on the finances of everything. And, you know, just personally with my own, you know, luxury and privilege, I have more slack in that arena. So afterwards, after being like so insulted, I was like, man, I really should have told that woman my mortgage and made her cry. Because I can't, you know, I can't even like fathom what rent is in Los Angeles, right? Like, there's no way.
That's a good point. They probably don't have time to do any hobbies.
Right.
Or do side gigs to just like pay the bills.
That person is painting. They're a painter. They're painting 8 to 14 hours a day.
Wow.
To make that a full-time job. And I was kind of like, I literally cannot and will not do that. That is not, is that the advice? Okay, bye. But also, in regards to podcasting, I literally did not ask. But yeah, so I'm a little bit sad I didn't try to make that person cry, but
Newsflash, this is a highly unsuccessful podcast.
So unsuccessful. I mean, we're in the top 1%, but I guess, well, yeah.
The bar
guess,
is low.
I guess it depends how you define success. And maybe we don't have to be, like, so competitive about everything.
God, I know.
Which I think Minneapolis, at least in my experience, is at least coming from Chicago, is way better about that. Like, people are not so career focused in that, like, I have to be the best way. And then when I go back to Chicago, everybody just talks about work and, like, I don't know. It's a very different mindset. And I think it's because, yeah, like, it's just more expensive and everybody's commute is so long. You know, it just, like, takes up so much time. Right. And then I'm just like, oh my God, I have to move away again. I'm not cut out for this. So yeah, no, we're never going to make it. I'm so sorry, Samantha.
Well, that's fine. Do I even want to make it?
See, that's the thing. Okay.
Really. I don't know.
If I wanted
to make it, I'd probably put more effort into it, to be honest.
But also, we would have, like, so much more pressure, right? Like, if we were actually paying our mortgages because of this podcast, it would, like, really have to fucking keep working. Like, say we hired an editor, say we had employees. Like, oh no, now we have to really keep it going so we can play, because we don't want to fire them, right? Like, it's like,
I want the ability to just quit at any moment.
I want the ability to crawl out of my bed. I'm literally still in my pajamas. I've only, like, vaguely brushed my teeth, brushed my hair, taken my medicine, and sat down, right? Like, that's what happened for me to get here. I don't want to be like, oh my God, I got to get back to the underwear.
To pay the rent on the studio.
What? Oh my God. I got to get back to the underwear subscription people because of the blob, you know, like...
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know. I think it would be a lot less fun, and I bet you would be able to tell in the what we made that it was much more laborious and yeah, that we were worried all the time, like, oh shit, we gotta pay those podcasting bills are coming in, opposed to me sitting here in my dining room, you know.
There's a reason I've routinely said that we don't actually want more than 5 listeners. This is fine. We don't need to grow.
No.
This is perfectly fine.
Also, I kind of like all of our listeners. And I, just from being in, like, online groups and stuff, there is definitely a tipping point where once you get to a certain number of people, like, you are not going to like all of them.
Absolutely.
And that there, some of them are going to be, like, a real problem. So I feel like we're at a nice, comfortable level where, like, we're happy with what we're doing. We like the people who are listening. Like, we'll just never make it. We'll never impress people in Los Angeles.
It's never really been my goal to impress people in Los Angeles, so not that worried about it.
Mac and I were once in California, and for some reason, Mac was the one being really social. That's weird. Anyway, he was out by the pool, and I was, like, taking a nap or some shit. I was not there. And someone was like, oh, so have you ever considered relocating out here? And Mac was like, I guess the way I've thought, oh, it'd be nice to own a yacht. Like, like, if we're just talking about shit that's never going to happen, sure, yeah, that sounds great. I'll do that any minute.
No kidding.
Because I put on my gold top hat and monocle. I feel like I had another thing to complain about, and now I don't even remember. I got so into that
one. We can come back to it.
Anyway. Who goes first in this episode?
I believe it's me.
Oh yeah, okay. Great.
Talking about Oklahoma City.
Yes, this is a very 90s. I know they're all, like, very 80s, 90s, but this one really taps into some, like, 90s current events of the day.
Yeah. Robert Stack is even outside the rubble of Oklahoma City. There's a fence, little memorial kind of on the fence, and it really transports you back in time.
It's super interesting to watch this now, I think, personally, because the degree to which we didn't really take this seriously, considering, you know, like, post 9/11 government action, I find super interesting. Like, there just used to be domestic terrorism shit that would happen every so often. You know, there'd be the Unabomber, or there would be this, or there was the an earlier event at the Twin Towers. And somehow when the people that did those things were, you know, white and from the U.S., I don't know, we just didn't really freak out about it that much.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed is there's a lot of footage played from immediately after the bombing. So you see people covered in blood, pandemonium, ambulances. Yeah. And I thought about how that scene has become so ubiquitous. Like, you know, every couple months we have a scene like that in America now.
Kind of every day. Yeah, kind of every day.
I guess I was being a little generous, but you know, the mass tragedy, the mass casualty event, and like seeing those images, it's like carbon copy. You know, not much has really changed. And I found that, you know, disheartening.
You're right.
And yeah, I don't really have anything deep to say about it, but I was watching that footage like, wow, this is just the same.
It's like we've gotten really good at this part.
The immediate aftermath. And it's eerie how like exactly the same that footage is, just shot on older cameras.
That's a really good point.
So that's depressing. But anyway, this is the Unsolved Mysteries Wiki called it Lost Rescuers, which I think is cute. This is the savior. We're looking for the saviors of Duane Miller. It's a lost love style mystery in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Let's pretend it's a lost love and he actually had a crush on one of the rescuers.
I love that. Sorry to his wife, but
it's like a missed connections thing like they used to have in the newspaper.
Yeah.
It'd be like, I saw
they
you
locked
in the
eyes.
Train. Yeah.
In
you
the rubble.
You were wearing red lipstick and reading The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
I love that.
Let's get coffee that. Sometime.
So we meet 55-year-old Duane Miller, who's married, fathered of three. He was a victim of the Oklahoma City bombing. He wasn't really like supposed to be. It's not like he worked in there. He was actually just visiting the credit union. And it was kind of a split second decision. He was just there to pick up, I think, some paperwork. He like swung by in the course of doing his day. His wife didn't even know he was going to be there.
Yeah, he's but just like running errands and he's like, oh, right, I need those papers. Better swing by that building.
Right. And he lived sort of in the area, so I don't know where he was going, but he just stopped by at like 9 in the morning. This was obviously April 19th, 1995. While he was in the credit union, the bomb exploded, we're told, 80 feet away from where he was.
Jesus.
He fell two floors and ended up dangling upside down, suspended by cables and wires about 10 feet above the rubble below him.
I had no idea this happened in real life. This is something seriously out of a movie. I did not know that you could really be like caught hanging upside down.
I mean, like, later on, he says that suspended. Basically like everybody who was in that credit union with him died, and you could see how this is like a total freak thing that he just happened to be caught up, or he probably would have been dead too. He was flung hundreds
right.
of feet.
Right.
So eventually he was sort of able to wiggle his legs out and then fell 10 feet to the debris below.
Oh, that fall. God.
He was unable to move his legs. We hear that his basically every like tendon and ligament in his knees were torn. His knees were basically obliterated. He also couldn't see out of his right eye, but he was sort of able to wipe it and kind of, you know, get that cleared. He wasn't that far from the opening to the building, but of course he couldn't walk. And so he started dragging himself, and he made it about a couple feet. Like, I guess the opening was like 50 feet, but he made it like halfway there until he was just completely exhausted, unable to go any farther. That's at that point, two unidentified men came through the opening to the building and found Duane. They were able to drag and sort of lift him up out of the debris. They helped him outside, made sure he was okay, and then they ran right back in to help other injured survivors. So Duane was transported to the hospital where he stayed for several weeks. Even today, he still has pain walking, and he probably always will. He also has, even at the point of filming, he has many surgeries ahead of him to try and repair the damage that was done to his knees. But he knows that he is still alive today because of the two men who were able to get him out of that building. So he wants to thank them for what they did. He says that one of the men was black, the other was white. They were in their late 20s or early 30s at the time, which was 1985. They were dressed in street clothes, and they may have worked in downtown Oklahoma City. Unfortunately, I'm sad to say that there is no resolution to this case. It remained unsolved, and Duane actually passed away in 2011 at the age of 70. And we're told that, I looked it up on Unsolved Mysteries, we didn't learn this in the episode or Unsolved Mysteries wiki, but he died because of debris in his lungs.
That's so sad.
Yeah, I know. And he never found the men who saved his life that day.
That's wild to me, because I just feel like if anything, people would want to take credit for this. Like, even if they weren't the people who did it, I feel like, yeah. Like, oh yeah, that was me. Like, they just saved so many people that day, and maybe didn't really, like, register as that big of a deal. I don't know.
And they may not have, like, recognized him. You know, there's probably a lot of people pitching in. So, you know, unfortunately, not all of them get solved. But I was kind of hoping there would be a reunion.
I thought the reenactment for this was really good.
It was really good. I don't know where that, like, set was with inside the building, but it was kind of incredible.
It was pretty realistic. It was a definitely higher production value than I would expect from Unsolved Mysteries, where it seemed believable that this was the inside of a bombed building. And
it did.
They must have had a stunt guy to do the hanging upside down thing. So
right, in the fall and everything. So yeah. I thought it was really excellent.
Yeah, it was well done. Okay. So now we have a wanted. On November, finally we get. I feel like we've been talking about this for years because someone told us it was coming, and finally,
I actually thought we'd already seen this, but I think it's just because we've talked about it so much.
We've talked about it so much. So here we go. It was November 27th, 1985. It was the night before Thanksgiving when three men arrived at a grocery store in Greenville, South Carolina. These men were paroled armed robber Sam Woodkey, convicted drug dealer Rusty Corvette, and Sam's 19-year-old son, Richard Woodkey.
Okay, was that the name on his birth certificate? Do we know? Did he come out and his parents were like, Rusty Corvette? Did they know they were sentencing him to a life of crime? Because what else could you do as Rusty Corvette but commit crimes? You
know, some people name their kids weird ass shit. I think Matthew McConaughey has a nephew named Miller Light McConaughey.
Okay, that's kind of incredible, actually.
Miller Light McConaughey. So someone out there had a kid, and as you know, we're not a big fan of the name Rusty, but they decided, our last name is Corvette, which is pretty fucking bitchin'. And you know what would be really funny is if our kid was named something that goes with the word Corvette. I don't know, like Rusty. Look, man.
Okay, I think I found it. It was not his real name.
How dare you? You
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I think his real name was Wilbur Rutledge.
Well, okay, if that's your name, of course you're going to go by Rusty Corvette.
Would you rather be Wilbur Rutledge or Rusty Corvette?
Think about
Rusty Corvette, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Wilbur Rutledge sounds like one of those presidents that was only around for 3 weeks and then died of the flu or something.
Okay, I do love this article I found, though. So he, spoiler alert, he ended up dying in a police shootout. And so I found an article about that shootout, and they do say that his, you know, they mention his real name at the beginning, but for the rest of the article they just refer to him as Corvette.
Wow, amazing. Okay, so anyway, they're robbing a store, and maybe you're like, why would you rob a grocery store like in the movie Sugar and Spice? Well, it's the day before Thanksgiving, so there was gonna be a lot of cash on hand, particularly back in 85. People used credit cards way less. Okay, so that night Sam and Corvette enter the store. I copied and pasted some of the Unsolved Mysteries wiki, and yeah, they just refer to him as Corvette, and it's very funny. Corvette put on a ski mask and demanded money from one of the managers. Woodkey ordered everyone in the store to lay on the ground, while Corvette took the money, which was only like $8,000 for three of them. I don't know, maybe it wasn't worth it. We hear from an eyewitness that says that Woodkey was not wearing a ski mask, and that actually scared her the most, because she was like, he doesn't care if we can recognize him. Is he planning to kill us all?
It's a really good point.
But fortunately, that's not what happened. Corvette orders everyone back to the back of the store. And when some of them didn't move, he did fire a shot at some soda cans. And then they left the store saying, "It's been a pleasure," and returned to their car where that guy's son, Richard, was waiting. As they left the store, two employees who apparently take their jobs really seriously ran outside and wrote down the make and license plate number of the car. And then I think they tried to set up roadblocks. I don't remember if that works. So we hear from a sheriff deputy named Park Evans. That sounds like a fake name. But anyway, I called his mustache Lord Help Us All because I did not like this mustache. It I really don't like it when a mustache, goes out as you expect, but then comes back around the lip. I hate that.
Yeah, that's...
I find it unsettling. So anyway, that's why the universe told me that's what his mustache is named. So within minutes, several officers were closing in on the robbers. One of the cars had Officer Donald Eubanks, and I'm so confused with this term, volunteer constable.
I didn't understand that either.
You can just volunteer.
Why do we have volunteers being police officers?
Oh my god.
He seemed older. Maybe he was a retired police officer that came back to Hopefully he had some training. I don't know.
People could just show up and be like, "Give me a gun. I'm gonna take down some bad guys." It's like that meme that was going around back in 2020 about how you've probably been playing Animal Crossing longer than it takes to become a cop. And I was like, oh my god, I have. Anyway.
Absolutely.
It's like you've put more hours into Animal Crossing than anyone has into becoming a police officer. Good to know. Oh god, where was I? So whatever, they're driving, they're trying to get away before they could set up the roadblock. They fired some shots at a patrol car, which killed 43-year-old Valden Keith. That was the volunteer constable. So maybe don't volunteer to be on your police department because you might actually get shot and killed by some robbers. And sadly, he was a father of four. Within 48 hours, authorities had arrested all three suspects. Sam was the one charged with first-degree murder for killing that volunteer constable, and he faced the death penalty. While awaiting trial, Woodkey and Corvette created a scheme wherein they would place the blame on Sam's own son, Richard. But guess what? That didn't work out. You can't trust someone named Rusty Corvette.
This is the problem.
Yeah, so obviously, Rusty turned on him. They both testified that Sam was the shooter. I'm not sure we really know who fired that. Anyway, whatever. They turned on Sam. So Sam was convicted of murder, and he was sentenced to life without a parole. He vowed to escape, supposedly telling one of the police officers in charge, "Life ain't nothing."
Okay.
Because he didn't get the death penalty. Which, the death penalty for killing one person? Okay, whatever. I mean, I'm just against the death penalty. So I was why was that even an option? 8 years later, on January 8th, 1994, Woodkey and another inmate named Danny Lale were assigned to an unsupervised landscaping job on the prison grounds. Look, it's fine if you want people to escape from prison. I don't support our prison system. But if you're giving people unsupervised landscaping jobs...
In a maximum security prison? This doesn't seem maximum security, I'm not gonna lie. This seems less than maximum, to be honest.
Just be fine with them escaping, then. You know what I mean? That's just part of the risk of doing. If you want that free labor of landscaping and you're not willing to send someone out to watch them, just accept that they might leave.
Where is it? It was a Saturday.
Yeah, which meant they also didn't have a midday head count, so it was extra easy for them to escape.
Again, is maximum security really the right term?
I also that they would be aware of that. It's so scheduled. Literally every Saturday they don't do a midday head count. So it's they know that they won't be counted and they'll have extra time to get away. Wow. Okay. So the convicts used a stolen hacksaw, which again, that's something they have access to, apparently, to gain access to an underground maintenance tunnel. Honestly, kind of boss. The men had to slip through three wire gates, a steel door, and rebar between two wire mesh gates. Okay, but again, they had like 8 hours to do this because no one knew they were not where they were supposed to be. The only people that realized they were up to something were other prisoners that were like, oh shit, we don't want to get implicated in this, right? Like, we're not going to stop you, obviously. We don't want to get hurt, but also we don't want to get in trouble. So at least in the reenactment, you hear one of the guys going, get some rope so we can hogtie ourselves so that they can act like they were tied up when this happened so that they don't get in trouble. Hilarious. Okay, so yeah, they had 8 hours. And, by 4:30 p.m., they had made it to the boiler room, which I guess is where those guys are that had to hogtie themselves. And with just 15 minutes to spare before that nighttime headcount, they escaped driving a prison truck. How did they get access to that?
They just got the keys, drove away.
Oh, my God. Anyway, although authorities arrested Lael 1 month later, Sam remained at large, so this was a wanted segment about him. But if you're worried he's going to come rob your grocery store, he's not, because he was captured. Immediately after the broadcast, a viewer contacted Unsolved Mysteries, claiming that a former co-worker named Michael G. Allman was actually Woodkey. Authorities found a driver's license in Louisiana with that name, and with that information, when you pick a fake name, don't pick something literally no one else has.
Yeah, that's right. Be that's Joe Smith or whatever.
Yeah. My name is Liz Walker. Good luck Googling that. There's a lot of Liz Walkers. You want something like that.
You gotta be un-Googleable.
Yeah, you need something with some anonymity. Okay. So with that information, they were able to locate him at a rooming house in Morgan City, Louisiana. On March 30th, 1996, he was arrested there, and then they figured out, oh yeah, that really is him. So he was the 135th fugitive captured thanks to the show. On April 4th, 1996, he returned to prison, and he was given an extra 25 years to his life sentence.
Well, I don't... Okay.
He already had a life sentence. Like, what does he care?
Seems like he does it.
Yeah, he's just going to try to escape again. Anyway. But he died of a heart attack in 2005 at the age of 60. And as Samantha said, Rusty Corvette served 11 years in prison before being released. And then in 1997, he died in a shootout with police during a botched robbery attempt. So RIP Rusty Corvette. I don't know if you killed that deputy or not, but with a name like that, you seem like a true American icon.
So. I know that Sam Wedke was a dirtbag, but did the universe say anything about his mustache? Because Robert Stack had some words about his mustache.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Apparently, this guy, when he was first arrested, did like some sort of PR campaign where he was like talking to the media. And Robert Stack describes him as sporting a dapper mustache and a cavalier attitude.
Do you think Robert Stack was like a little jealous of his mustache?
Maybe. His mustache was very full. It had some like, it was like wide, like up and down. I don't know how to describe it, but it was like, there's a lot there.
Yeah, no, it was very lush. It was very, full, yeah.
I don't know if I would describe it as dapper.
No,
honest. That's just me, but
yeah. I am gonna call this mustache Robert Stack's envy.
Perfect.
Because it's like
it is the envy of Robert Stack, apparently.
Yeah, it's probably part of his contract. He can't have facial hair or something. You know, he's like, oh man, I wish I had enough to shave every day, and I could have a sweet mustache like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Moving on.
Well, now we get, to be honest, a rather boring mystery about handwriting analysis.
Yeah, again, you're getting like the most 90s mysteries of all time.
Yeah, because this is about the Clintons and the Whitewater scandal, sort of. So this Unsolved Mysteries calls this The Investigators. That's what the category of the segment. We are talking about the suicide, or was it, of Vince Foster, who was an aide and close confidant of Bill Clinton.
Close personal friend, yes.
Yes.
This was a very big news story back at the time. It's not really something we talk about now. I think the Clinton PR people have really done their best to make sure this is not a name anyone remembers or speaks of. So if Samantha and I mysteriously vanish, you know why.
Yeah, exactly. Look at all the railroad tracks in the area.
exactly.
On July 20th, 1996.
For the record, when we turn up dead, Samantha did not smoke 40 marijuana cigarettes, okay? I just want that known.
It's officially recorded in the record.
Yeah, that's not really Samantha's style. So be suspicious when that's the official explanation of our deaths.
Liz, though.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I try to smoke at least 40 at a time. I have a special, I don't even know what you call it, but it's like a harmonica, and you put all the joints you put 40 joints into it, and then
listen, it's legal now. Angel,
it's legal to do something that stupid. They can't stop you. If you want to smoke 40 marijuana cigarettes at once, there's nothing they can do.
On July 20th, 1993, President Bill Clinton's deputy counsel, Vincent Foster, died unexpectedly. He was 48. His body was found in a park across the Potomac River from Washington. Foster had been shot once in the head. The wound was apparently self-inflicted. Uh-huh. At the time of his death, he had been implicated in the Whitewater scandal. Google it. I'm not going to talk about the Whitewater scandal. The United States Park.
That's so boring.
It's so fucking boring.
It's the most boring scandal ever.
Oh my God. The United States Park Police and the FBI concluded that Foster had taken his own life, but journalists raised serious doubts about that theory. Among them, really? Okay, we are told that it was basically only like Republican newspapers, but some journalists raised doubts.
I have purposely not really learned a lot about Robert Stack as a person. I couldn't tell you like what his political affiliations are, but just based on watching this show, I'm going to guess they're like conservative leaning, you know?
Probably.
Despite hosting a show that's constantly pointing out how the police department failed and that's why these mysteries are unsolved, he does seem to be like, you know, kind of pro that sort of thing. So for him to be like, look, it's just a bunch of Republican crank newspapers, it's very funny to me.
Well, it was true. So we get this guy, investigative reporter Christopher Ruddy, who says that Vince Foster was the highest federal official to die under suspicious circumstances since President Kennedy. And he says that he doesn't normally push non-suicide theories. And he's not saying that Vince Foster was murdered. He's just saying that he's got questions about the police's investigation or lack thereof.
This is the most like Fox News way of talking, except that he's not yelling, where he's just like, I'm just asking questions. What's wrong with that? And it's like, well, they're not valid questions. So there's that. I mean, yeah,
exactly. My God, exactly. Yeah. His point is that the police normally treat every suspicious death as a homicide until they have evidence to the contrary. But in this case, it doesn't seem like they did that. I'm not really sure what he's basing that off of, because if the evidence is overwhelming, they're not going to look into it as a murder further. But I'm not saying that this guy wasn't, you know, suicided. But like, I don't know. The evidence we see in this episode is not convincing.
Also, if this guy was clearly not an Unsolved Mysteries viewer, because if you were, you would know that tons of cases that were brought to Unsolved Mysteries by families, the cops show up and immediately go, this is a suicide, and they don't investigate it at all.
So yeah, I thought about that like too.
Pretty standard practice, whether it should be or not.
Like, yeah, actually, police do it all the time. So not sure what you're talking about, Chris.
It's a fundamentally lazy profession. Yeah. They are not trying to make extra paperwork for themselves. And if there is, I don't know, something like a suicide note, they're definitely going to go, okay, let's all take a break.
The evidence can be overwhelming that it's a homicide. People could be shot in like the back of the head and they'll still be like, yeah, looks like a suicide to me.
Which answer doesn't involve me working on Saturday? Is it that this is a suicide? Okay, great. It's a suicide.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the key clues in this case is a note allegedly written by Vince Foster. The message was unsigned, and when it was found, it had been ripped into 28 pieces.
That is a lot.
Yeah, and they reconstructed it. We see it on Unsolved Mysteries, and it read, in part, quote, "I made mistakes from ignorance, inexperience, and overwork. I did not knowingly violate any law or standard of conduct. No one in the White House, to my knowledge, violated any law or standard of conduct. I was not meant for the job or the spotlight of public life in Washington. Here, ruining people is considered sport." No. I guess I can kind of see why the phrase "no one in the White House, to my knowledge, violated any law or standard of conduct" being in the suicide note is a little suspicious.
It's not how people generally talk, but it doesn't seem impossible that that's how someone who works for the president would talk.
Sure. You know what I mean? I don't think so.
But it is awfully convenient that he's like, well, I'm about to die. I better write something exonerating Bill Clinton. Like that.
Exactly. That's probably a little suspicious.
Probably wouldn't be my first thought. I might like think of my family or something. But, you know, I'm not Bill Clinton's close personal friend.
Well, yeah, exactly.
It's just another sign that this podcast is never going to make it.
That we're never. not close personal friends with the Clintons.
I mean, thank fucking Christ. Jesus.
God. The shredded note was found in Foster's briefcase 4 days after his death. Curiously, White House counsel Bernard Nussbaum had searched the briefcase earlier but did not find the note.
That is honestly the most suspicious part of it to me. But then you're like, well, it was all ripped up. Did he even realize what it was? Like, maybe he just didn't do a very good job of looking.
Is it kind of stuffed in a pocket somewhere? I don't know. Also, no offense, men, if you even listen to the show, men have a way of looking at something that's right in front of their face and not seeing it. I do not understand this phenomenon, but there's a reason there's memes about men not being able to find the ketchup in the refrigerator, even though it's right in front of their face.
Okay, but that's me, though. I feel like I have like some weird refrigerator blindness.
Well, maybe refrigerator blindness is a thing, but I do think generally speaking, men can look at something that's right there and not see it. I don't get it. So sorry, Bernard, but this isn't enough evidence for me.
Samantha's like,
you didn't see the ripped up note.
Samantha's like, gender's not real, but why can't men see for shit? And you're asking the important questions.
Really? On October 25, 1995, more than 2 years after Foster died, a team of well-known handwriting experts held a press conference in Washington. Each of the experts examined a photocopy of the alleged suicide note and concluded that it was a forgery. Unsolved Mysteries invited these men to meet with them in Boston to explain their conclusions. The experts compared the suicide note to 12 other samples of Foster's handwriting. We hear from Ronald Rice, a handwriting expert who has worked for the state of Massachusetts. He is convinced that the note is forged, mainly because of the differences in the capital I's. They kind of like swoop differently in each of them. I don't know. That's a unique way of writing an I, and it's very similar in both. So I don't know. But basically, all of these men come to the conclusion that someone was trying to match his handwriting and doing a bad job.
I did not find this convincing.
I was not convinced at all.
Maybe because they were originally hired by like a weird fringe Republican newsletter. But also, like, they show you the comparative samples and you're like, those look
similar. We hear from Reginald Alton. Seems like a fitting name for this guy, to be honest. He works for Oxford University in England, and he talks about the comparison.
His name
of
is literally Reginald.
Reginald Alton, who works for Oxford University.
I'm surprised he doesn't have 12 names, though. That's actually what's weird.
Actually, yeah. It's amazing he didn't have a monocle, but whatever. Maybe he left it at home.
Yeah, probably.
He compared the word Clintons, the name Clintons in the suicide note, to known samples of him writing Clintons, and they showed those side by side. They were indistinguishable. They looked exactly the same.
Exactly the fucking same.
And he has kind of distinctive handwriting, I would say. And, like, they look... They're you cannot tell the two apart.
He has very legible handwriting for a man.
Yeah. And for it being cursive.
Gender, yeah, it's very, it's good.
It's distinctive, and I feel like the suicide note, either someone did a real good job of imitating his handwriting, or it literally is him, which seems more likely.
Hey, there is really nothing to suggest as a forgery. I feel like there is a real problem with confirmation bias here. I don't know if it would be possible to get people to examine this note without knowing what it was, but the, like, political aspect of this, it just makes it really hard to believe what they're saying.
I agree with you.
It's wild to me how much Republicans fucking hated Bill Clinton, considering what a conservative president he was. What the hell is your problem? He's gonna dismantle welfare. Shut up. He's gonna give you everything you want. It's just like you're checking a different box. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's absurd. I also feel like handwriting analysis, like a lot of quote-unquote forensic sciences, it's more of an art than a science. Sure. And I just feel like the conclusions these guys are coming to just doesn't make any sense. They talk about the hesitation dots, small blobs of ink left where the pen starts and stops. And I'm like, okay, well, even if those are hesitation dots, could they not be like explained by the fact that he was writing a suicide note?
He's like,
maybe he's a little stressed
about
maybe
what
he has some
write.
Hesitation about, yeah, he's thinking really hard about it. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. We do get an alternative point of view, which is good. This is retired homicide investigator Vincent Solis. He's a certified document examiner. He points to the fact that the words beginning with the letters TH are much more crudely written in the suicide note. Or wait, I'm reading off the wrong one. This is the third. I was reading off the wrong note. Vincent Solis is actually one of the three that Unsolved Mysteries talks to in Boston who thinks that it's a forgery. He was talking about the fact that the THs are crudely written and sloppier, or they're crudely written in the suicide note. And he claims that even if you are under stress, your writing might get sloppy, less clear, but your style of writing would not change. Mm-hmm. But then we hear from Marcel Matley. This is the alternative conclusion that a different expert comes to. He believes that some of the inconsistencies seen on frequently used words like the and to were part of Foster's writing style. So he shows us how, like, yes, in the suicide note, he writes certain words in different ways. Sometimes he writes his O's one way. Other times he writes them a different way. When he writes Clinton, sometimes he uses an apostrophe. Sometimes he doesn't. But in the samples of known writing, he does the same thing. And so this consistent inconsistencies is just part of how he writes. That to me seemed more plausible than, you know, looking at one way he writes as like one eye.
I was just going to say that the argument about the photocopier I found very valid.
Yeah, he also points out that the suicide note had been copied over and over and over again. And so a lot of what you're seeing is caused by just like poor quality photocopying. There's also tears that like don't necessarily show up as clean lines. It's just where like parts of the words don't meet. And he says that you have to ignore those completely. And a lot of what the other experts were pointing to were like just breaks in letters that were probably issues with the photocopier. Or certain loops would be more closed. And he said that is more than likely just poor photocopying, that when he was actually writing it, it wasn't like that.
I think they're also ignoring that this note was written into 28 pieces. So places where letters are distorted, are we sure that's not falling on a tear, Mark?
Right. And so he ignores those and only considers other aspects, which are to me pretty convincing. Like Foster consistently writes the same way, and you see the same like inconsistencies in the known writing where he'll write the TH in lowercase sometimes and then uppercase other times. He does the same thing in the suicide note. So you can pretty, I think, safely conclude that it was written by the same person. Anyway, this is literally the entire segment is just about the suicide note. It's pretty boring, to be honest. I don't know. I'm sure there's still conspiracy theories to this day about his death being a suicide, but or not being a suicide, but I kind of don't care.
Anyway, Robert Stack says that lingering questions may never be laid to rest.
The thing is, people are going to just move on and totally forget this. So that's kind of not true. I just don't think anyone cares at this point. There really were people that were like, Bill Clinton is a murderer at the time. Norm MacDonald went on The View and said that Bill Clinton was a murderer. Look that clip up. Okay. Where they're asking him who he's going to vote for. And he's like, well, probably the one that's not a murderer. And people are like, what? But I don't know, maybe. I think, okay, so we talked about the Boys on the Tracks case a while ago. And I think that was before all that Epstein shit came out. And so it does lend a little bit of credence to that story. But you know what? I'm not going to really get into it because I want to live.
Yeah, same.
So
we know nothing about any boys.
We know nothing
tracks.
About it. Samantha's too busy smoking 40 marijuana cigarettes at once to figure out if Hillary Clinton herself rolled those boys onto the tracks. Maybe she did. Maybe she didn't. We're never gonna know. I did remember the other thing I wanted to complain about, which I've been waiting for us to get a one-star review because someone on the internet took issue with me saying that white supremacy is a problem. Well, Samantha, I don't know if you know this, but I am white, and so are you.
Wait, what?
And that was pretty much their whole point was that I was apparently being hypocritical because I am white and I co-host a podcast with another white person, and I was like, wow, great observation.
I do not understand how that makes you hypocritical.
I guess that I should have forced someone else to be my friend so that the podcast was more diverse. I'm not sure.
Okay.
The podcast is very white. I was like, you're right. We're both white. We both benefit from white supremacy and white privilege. Great observation. And then they said something about how I'm wrong. Yeah, I was like, great observation. What does that have to do with anything? And this person was like, well, I assume you're young and you'll learn better. And I was like, thanks for calling me young. And I just blocked them. I was like, well, you've clearly seen a photo of me to know that I'm white. So guess I'm looking pretty good.
Yeah, I would say so.
Hilarious. So yeah, I guess. Sorry, everyone. Sorry, I'm white. It's not a lot I can do about it. The internet, really, can we turn that off already? I realize we won't be able to make the podcast anymore, but...
How will I get my shrimp memes?
Oh, yeah, you're right. The memes. God, the memes. Can someone just... Can we go back to, like, cut-paste me? Can I just, like, make collage memes and send those out by hand?
Just by mail? By snail mail?
Yeah, can we start snail mailing memes so that we can just let the sharks bite through those cables that keep the internet together? Because this was a mistake.
I don't disagree with you, but then I don't know how we'll distribute our podcast either.
We're going to have to put it on cassette tapes and send it out.
Oh, okay.
So look forward to that service in the future.
We're going to increase our Patreon.
We're going to have to start doing this over ham radio. Prepare yourselves, everybody. All right, so I have to talk about a mystery I was not prepared to talk about at all. Which
I'm so sorry because this one is rough,
but that's okay. According to Unsolved Mysteries Wiki, author James Elroy was just 10 years old when his mother, Geneva Jean Elroy, was raped and strangled to death by an unknown man. Jean was divorced from James' father and worked as a staff nurse at a Los Angeles factory and lived near El Monte. She had custody of her son during the week. Every Saturday, he would take the bus and stay with his father. On Sundays, he would return by cab. Okay, that's like way more specific than we needed to know, but now you know. Let's get more into his modes of transportation, please.
Well, I do think the point is that when his mom was murdered, he like pulled up in a cab.
Yeah, true.
Which is like gotta be even more traumatizing. Like you're not even with someone you know. You just get dropped off by a cab in a crime scene where your mom has been murdered.
Yeah, that's pretty dramatic. That sounds horrible.
Fucking yikes.
So, however, on Sunday, June 22nd, 1958, he returned home to find a policeman in his yard. And according to the reenactment, the policeman literally leans over and is like, son, your mom's dead. Where's your dad? Like, what? You might want to brace him a little bit. Okay, anyway.
He talks about how people have told him that it's weird that he didn't, like, break down in hysterics when he learned this. But think about a 10-year-old, like, it's not even a 10-year-old's possibilities in their brain, right, that their parents could die. And to just be suddenly thrust into the scene where a police officer is screaming, "Your mom's dead? Where's your dad?" Like, what?
I think we all assume our parents are going to die kind of slowly from old age or maybe a horrible disease.
And that's as adults. As a kid, I feel like you've never even thought about it once in your life.
So it's not even a thing that
could happen.
Yeah, son, your mom's been brutally murdered. Where's your dad? Like, oh, okay. After her death, James' life turned for the worse, especially after his father's death. It doesn't say here, but I want to say his dad died when he was like 17 or something like that.
I think he said that, yeah.
He drank, he used drugs, he was he became like a petty criminal, breaking into homes, stealing cars, stuff like that. During the 60s and 70s, he spent several years in and out of prison. However, he eventually sobered up because he was interested in writing crime novels, which he had become obsessed with reading after his mother's death. Clearly, like, he thought maybe, like, I want to know, like, how murders are solved, and maybe I'll be able to solve my mom's death, right? So he starts writing. In 1982, his first book was published. Within the next decade, he would publish 10 more crime novels. He sort of rose to fame after the book The Black Dahlia, which is a fictionalized account of the murder of Elizabeth Short, which we've talked about before on this podcast. So it was in 1994 that James finally thought he was ready to take on his mother's 36-year-old murder and look through the evidence of his mother's case. So we see a reenactment with him of him going to the police department and, like, getting the file and, like, demanding to see all the crime scene photos, even though the cop's like, I don't know that you want to see all of these. Like, maybe you want me to pull a few out that are especially grim. And he's like, no, I got to see them all.
I don't want to, like, I don't know, criticize the way someone, like, processes something like this or responds to it or whatever, but I was a little creeped out by the way he talks about, like, murder and sexual violence.
He does bring up, and I think this fits in with his books too, though I don't know that I've ever read any. He definitely, like, really hit on the fact that his books have a lot of sex in them and that there's, like, a sexual
violence.
Like, right. I know there was a part when he was talking about how he needed to, like, sober up if he ever wanted to be a writer. And he was saying, because I wanted to write deliberate, edgy, perverted, something else, crime fiction. And I was like, that's really weird that you're like, man, I got to lay off the booze so I can write some really perverted stuff.
So, like, but it doesn't it make you think, like, he's thought a lot about what happened to his mom?
So I think he is obsessed. I think he's, I mean,
I don't, it doesn't seem healthy to me.
Don't sue me, James Ellroy, but I think it's kind of consumed his life. It's what the segment left me with that impression.
I think he might admit that it has consumed his life. He may have even said so in the episode. And I mean, look, nothing like this, thank God, has ever happened to me. So I can't really judge how someone responds to it, but it made me a little uncomfortable to hear. Not gonna lie.
The way he talks about it is odd. It strikes me as odd. It's not a comforting watch.
Yeah, agreed.
Okay, so he finally, while he's looking through this case file, he sees a composite of the suspected killer. He was able to locate a waitress named LaVon Chambers, who had waited on his mom and this man around 10 the night of her death at a drive-in. And specifically, she's so cute, and she's talking about, like, oh, I remember her. She was, like, so elegant and well-dressed and, like, super friendly and blah, blah, blah.
She remembers the dress, too. Like, she's a really good witness because she was wearing this beautiful blue floral dress, and she remembers exactly. She was like, I had one just like it.
Yeah. So that was around 10. Then later that night, his mom and this unknown man were also seen with an unidentified blonde woman at a bar called the Desert Inn.
They nicknamed him the Swarthy Man.
Yeah. Yeah. They say the word swarthy so many times. So if you're not already uncomfortable, just like from James Ellroy's whole deal, hearing the word swarthy 500 times.
The swarthy man.
You're like, all right, we got it. We got it, I guess. So anyway, witnesses that saw them at this bar, the Desert Inn, felt like this woman who was with them knew both Jean and the suspect. They seemed like old friends. She left with them around midnight. James believes that this woman is the key to solving his mom's murder and identifying this man, because clearly she knows who he was. She probably mentioned to other people they were going out. Like, it doesn't seem like they just met that night. Then the next place that his mom is seen is at 2:15 a.m. They go back to the same drive-in that they were at 10. They have the same waitress. And she was like, yeah, she doesn't like look like quite as fresh by this point in the evening. She looks like maybe she's been making out a little bit or something. And they like went to get some coffee and I don't know. But at this point, the blonde woman's not there. So she's only joined them at the bar. And then they leave the drive-in at 3 a.m. They believe that this man took Jean to the place where she was killed, a somewhat secluded area. I'm actually not remembering where her body was found. Was it found where she was killed? Like,
I think so. It was, I got the impression that it was like in like the, there, it was near their home. But it was kind of like off in the woods a little bit. There's this image, which I find very visceral, of like her pearls that she was wearing were scattered in the street. But I think she was found kind of in the woods or in the ditch or something, kind of like off the road. But I thought it was sort of near their home because that's where he was dropped off.
Right. So, I mean, you won't be surprised. What they believe happened is they leave the drive-in at 3. He takes her to a remote area. He puts the moves on her. She's like, look, I've had a nice time, but please take me home. And he won't take no for an answer, right?
Right.
Police believe the man seen with Jean at the night of her death is the killer. Oh, wow. They're so great at their
Seems
job.
Likely.
Anyway, her murder has yet to be solved. So the suspects are basically this one guy that was seen with her that night that they've nicknamed the Swarthy Man because he has dark hair and an olive complexion. I love it. One of the witnesses, she did distinctly like be like he had no accent. Not a southern accent, no accent. That was the waitress. Basically, he was like native to California, right? He didn't sound like he was from somewhere else. He was driving a 55 or 56 dark green Oldsmobile. He has never been identified. The police also are trying to find that blonde woman. I mean, she's still alive. She's very old at this point.
She would have been 70.
Yeah, and which means by this point, she's what, 90? I don't think she's... I'm going to guess she's not still among us, but maybe I'm wrong. They also wanted to talk to some of Jean's former co-workers to see if they knew who, like, she would be going on a date with, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't seem like the police really looked into this at all, honestly. They didn't talk to her co-workers at the time. Like, why do you have to do that on Unsolved Mysteries decades
that
later?
That was a question I had. Why didn't they talk to her co-workers then?
Yeah, I don't think they really tried. And is that because she's a single mom? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Right? So this segment originally aired on March 22nd, 1996. This remains unsolved. James went on to write a book called My Dark Places, which is about the murder of his mother. He's better known for his bestsellers, The Black Dahlia, LA Confidential, and American Tabloid. And I'm sure there's a lot more information about this. I mean, it's mostly just sad. I don't find it, like, particularly interesting. He's been interviewed on a few podcasts about it. Her grave is on Find a Grave, if you would like to pay your respects.
I feel like, is this a case that could be solved with the ancestry DNA? I mean, I realize he got to go to the police station and fucking touch everything, so I don't know if it's contaminated or if there is even any physical evidence, but...
Yeah, that's the thing, as I just don't think they did a good job.
Maybe they didn't collect any evidence.
Yeah.
That would really suck, because I feel like this is a case of anyone that could like be solved with ancestry DNA.
Yeah, I just don't know. I don't know if there's anything to compare to.
Yeah.
Anyway, sad story. And that is the end of this episode.
All right, let's rate it.
Okay.
Mysteriousness.
I think pretty mysterious. We never certainly the
last
out,
one was.
We never find out who rescued that guy from in Oklahoma. We never find out who murdered Gene Elroy. I guess we don't totally know what happened to Vince Foster. Maybe, possibly. I mean, we do, but maybe not. So I'm going to say highly mysterious, actually.
I think this one's quite mysterious, for sure.
Thumbs up.
I think the reenactments were also really good. We talked about the ones in the Oklahoma City mystery. Clearly, they put a lot of work into that, and it shows. I thought they were excellent.
The reenactments at the drive-in at this last mystery are good. They sort of set the scene. Yeah, I have no complaints. I don't. Yeah. We do get sort of a update. So long, I forgot that wasn't a segment. And that's why I got thrown off with who does what mystery. And that woman calls him Bob. So I don't appreciate that part of the episode, but otherwise it's pretty solid.
Yeah, no, I really liked it. Okay, can we give any points to fashion to James Elroy?
Yeah, he's wearing kind of like a Hawaiian shirt type of thing.
If someone found that California shirt he's wearing in the opening scene in a thrift store, it would be like, I don't know, those fashionable Gen Zers dream. They're wearing that with baggy jeans and just, it's all over TikTok.
I also, in my notes, had that one of the handwriting experts has, like, hair, metal hair. He has, like, giant, black, glossy mane. It's, like, it's so high maintenance hair that he, I mean, I guess he knew it was going on TV, but he really blew that the fuck out. He got some volume. So I think fashion, actually, we haven't been given a lot of thumbs up lately. It's not my strongest thumbs up, but I will give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think so, too. And Robert Stack, he was on scene multiple times in the handwriting segment. He was like in a gentleman's study with all the easels of the blown up handwriting behind him. It's quite a vignette.
I'm going to give him a thumbs up just for throwing shade at the source of the speculation in the suicide notes, where he was like, look, some very right wing papers don't think this is true, but I'm just for that alone. Thumbs up.
Yeah, no, I agree. So this episode, that was really good. I want to say it's like in the four range.
I'd give it a four. It could have used something paranormal to pop it up more, but it's solid.
Yeah, I agree.
It's worth watching. I would not skip it for sure. Okay, so I'm going to do for our found love segment. I cannot believe I haven't talked about this before. I want to talk about the essay Sick Woman Theory.
Oh, okay.
Which is very important to me. This is by Johanna Hedva. And when I don't remember when this was first published, not super long ago, but it's already become this really important work of sort of disability activism. So you can read this right now. For some reason, it's on a website called Topical Cream. Look, I don't know.
What?
But if you just Google sick woman theory, it'll come up. So what this is about is it's a sort of a response to philosopher Judith Butler's idea that anything we do in public is political. And this essay is saying, well, what if I can't get out of bed? Which is very rarely, very rarely an issue that I have, having fibromyalgia, and I just can't do everything that I want to do. And that this essay is about like how sometimes you are stuck taking care of yourself, and that makes it hard to throw a brick through the window of a bank, right?
Yeah.
So I just wanted to, in particular, read the end of this, you know, since we are in such just fucking awful times, it's something that I've been thinking about a lot. And this does not only apply to women, it is meant for all marginalized people, and the person who wrote this is non-binary, so don't feel like this doesn't apply to you. The most anti-capitalist protest is to care for another and to care for yourself, to take on the historically feminized and therefore invisible practice of nursing, nurturing, and caring, to take seriously each other's vulnerability and fragility and precarity, and to support it, honor it, empower it, to protect each other, to enact a practice of community of support, a radical kinship, an interdependent society, a politics of care. Because once we are all ill and confined to the bed, sharing our stories of therapies and comforts, forming support groups, bearing witness to each other's tales of trauma, prioritizing care and love of our sick, pained, expensive, sensitive, fantastic bodies, and there is no one left to go to work, perhaps then, finally, capitalism will screech to its much needed, long overdue, and motherfucking glorious halt.
Amazing.
Oh, it's God. It's so good. I really recommend checking this out. It's also been updated. When I was looking for this to read on the podcast, I realized it had been updated since the last time I read it. And Johanna has moved to Berlin with their partner since I last looked at it, and apparently their health has improved so much.
Oh, wow.
And that just makes me want to weep, honestly. It's so fucking depressing. I'm so happy for them, but for the rest of us, I was just like, oh my God. Because now they're actually getting like the support and medical care that they need, and guess what?
Their health has improved. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, like, I feel like living in Minnesota, I'm probably am getting like the best level of care that I could get in the United States. Like, I don't really have a complaint in that regard, but you know, maybe if I was living in Berlin, things would be even better. Right. Oh my God. I'm going to cry. Anyway. So that is my found love. I will link to that in our Facebook group, so everybody has a chance to look at it. It's not very long. So, yeah, give it a read.
Yeah, it's really important.
Did you have anything you wanted to talk about this week, my dear?
No.
Great.
And it certainly couldn't follow that up. So I'm going to say it's both of our found loves, and maybe I'll bring one to our next fortnightly episode.
Sounds fabulous. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Call your reps. I realize you do not care what we think, but they also shouldn't know a moment's peace. So
yeah.
So give them a call and be like, why are we aiding in genocide? Why is that how we spend money? Why are we, why is there always money for death and ruin and never money for anything good?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe just ask that question. I would encourage you to do so, even though, yeah, they do not give a shit what we think. It could not be more clear. Oh, God. Okay, no, we're not going to do that right now. I'm not going to spiral. We're just going to wrap this up. Okay, so you should give us a 5-star review, because who else is bringing you this quality?
Are you listening to this on YouTube podcasts? Can you review us on there?
Yes,
figure
please.
It out. Figure it out.
5 stars. We only accept 5 stars.
Can you like, I don't know if you can comment on our episode, say something nice, do something. I don't know how that works, but yeah, give it a try.
You should figure it out, and then you should do that. You should sign up to our Patreon, because we just did a really great episode about this notorious TV failure called Cop Rock. And yes, it is what it sounds like. It is a police procedural musical, and I really bet you want to hear me and Samantha get into that. That was a real thing that was on American television, everyone.
And it's a thing we've watched and talked about, and for just $1 you could get access to that episode plus over 70 episodes of bonus content, which is a great deal, not gonna lie.
Also, from watching Cop Rock, now my YouTube algorithm keeps recommending other songs from Cop Rock, which is a real joy. And I watched one last night and had fucking Sheryl Crow in it. So that
okay.
exists. That exists.
Interesting. Interesting.
Pre-fame Sheryl Crow sings a song about how it's basically like a pro-gun song for women.
Okay. Okay, Sheryl.
I bet you didn't see that coming.
I didn't.
No other podcast is bringing you this. No other podcast is going talking about disability activism and then that Sheryl Crow is on an episode of Cop Rock. We have the range.
It's really true. And if you have heard the news that we're going to get more episodes of the reboot of Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix, we only talk about that on our Patreon. So you have to give us $1 and then you will hear us. Whenever that comes out, we don't have a date, but whenever it comes out, you'll hear us talk about and break down those episodes.
Absolutely. So join our Facebook group that is still active, even though Facebook is a wasteland. Samantha is not really on Instagram anymore, but I am running our Perhaps It's You page. I update the stories there at least. And I also run my own page for my artwork. Everybody Likes Liz. So follow that. Follow Perhaps It's You. Oh, God. I said all that shit.
That's enough. That's enough.
Oh, send us your scary stories. Things that really happened to you. Perhaps it's you. podcast@gmail.com.
Have you seen a lake monster?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Have you seen something darker than the darkness? Do you know what happened to New Michelle?
Are there any updates on New Michelle?
Oh, God. Oh, God. Have you seen a UFO? We haven't gotten someone who's seen a UFO in a real long time. So if you've seen a UFO... Please write in.
Have you had a weird dream? Are you a twinless twin?
Twinless twins. Please write in. And twins. Sure. Did you once pull your groin and then your twin felt it? I want to know. I'm sick and perverted. Please write in and tell us about it. All right. Well, that's everything. Our podcast is not going to make it. Bye.